This is Emergency Medicine Match Advice, sponsored by Academic Life and Emergency Medicine, a podcast series designed to help medical students and residents strategically navigate the process of applying for residency in emergency medicine or to EM-sponsored fellowship programs. I'm your host, Mike Gisanti from Stanford University. Let's get started. Welcome once again to Emergency Medicine Match Advice, a Google Hangout web series sponsored by Academic Life and Emergency Medicine, and its editor-in-chief, my captain o' captain, Dr. Michelle Lin from the University of California, San Francisco. Hi, Michelle.
Hey there. You had me worried a little bit. I thought we were going to be doing like a mime thing and then just like freeze frame it. I'm like, I can do this with you.
Well, eventually we should do a behind-the-scenes episode, and you know, for the viewers out there, including our international audience today, there's usually a little button on Google Hangout Air that says on air, and mine says off air right now, so who knows.
Whatever.
But anyway, I want to welcome everyone. I'll wish you a happy September 15th, because today the ARIS mailbox is now open, marking the official start to interview season, much like hunting season, only more stressful. So we're back, and we're here to decrease your stress at the beginning of this whole process, hopefully give you some advice that's going to make you a little more comfortable and a little more strategic in your applications. This is Season 2, Episode 3. Get your popcorn and wine ready, because today's topic is EM match advice for the non-LCME applicant. And to offer their sage advice on this challenging topic, we again have three outstanding program directors with us. Dr. Merle Carter from Albert Einstein in Philadelphia. Hi, Merle.
Hello.
So Merle brings us some extra sage, if you will, as she was recently promoted from program director to designated institutional officer, which means she's like the head honcho of the program directors at Albert Einstein. So extra sage.
Extra sage.
Welcome Dr. Spicy. Doug Finifrock from Hackensack Medical Center in New Jersey.
Hey, welcome everybody.
And then my old pal from residency, Dr. Damon Keel, program director at Virginia Tech Carilion in the beautiful Roanoke, Virginia.
Hey, Mike, Michelle, thanks for having me. I'm looking forward to this talk.
Yeah, so am I. Today is EM match advice for the non-LCME applicant. But first, though, let's define what an LCME applicant is. An LCME applicant, for the purpose of the EM match advice discussions on Allium, is any applicant who is a medical student in their final year of training at an LCME-accredited institution, which is essentially most of the allopathic medical schools in the United States, Puerto Rico, and Canada. So if you are non-LCME, sometimes called an independent applicant in the U.S. match, you are either a former graduate of an LCME school who either did match last year or who has completed previous training in another residency program, a U.S. military service man or woman returning from military service and seeking a civilian residency program, a senior medical student or graduate of an osteopathic medical school in the United States, or a graduate of a medical school in a country other than the United States, Puerto Rico, or Canada, so called by we pretentious Americans, the international medical grads, or the IMG. So if you fall into these categories of applicants, this discussion certainly pertains to you. Now, this label non-LCME applicant is really just my fancy way of saying that you are a non-traditional applicant when compared to the majority of applicants who are generally senior medical students at allopathic schools in the U.S. We received a number of requests last year for this specific topic from viewers of EM Match Advice. Thanks for sending in your suggestions. We took these very seriously when choosing our topic, so I hope our viewers find this discussion helpful. And most especially because you guys are fighting an uphill battle of sorts, and certainly you come into the battle a little less competitive in some ways, just because we view you sort of as non-traditional. But that being said, I think the numbers perhaps are not as scary as you might think. And Michelle, I'm going to ask that you bring up the slide once again, just briefly this time. For those who haven't seen the slide, as I call it, in other installments of EM Match Advice, this is a summary slide that we put together each year that presents the NRMP data tables and results. NRMP is the National Residency Matching Program. And this is the NRMP data pertinent to the EM Match. And I want to draw your attention quickly just to two columns in the slide today. Column 6, which shows the percent fill rate with LCME applicants, and the last column that demonstrates the number of unmatched non-LCME or independent applicants in the EM match, specifically applicants who only apply to emergency medicine and not other specialties. The percent fill rate in column 6 hovers around 80%, which means that 20%, or one out of every five EM residency positions in the U.S. are filled by independent applicants. those aren't that bad of odds. If you play this game correctly and you approach interview season thoughtfully and strategically, this last column should also be somewhat reassuring in that over the last several years, on average, there's only been about 150 independent applicants who exclusively applied to EM and did not match. Now, it's important to note this unmatched number does not include the non-LCME applicants who applied to more than one specialty and didn't match. That number is much higher and has much more to do, I believe, with the characteristics of those applicants rather than the characteristics or competitiveness of the EM match or our specialty. So yes, emergency medicine is competitive. We have a fill rate around 80% by U.S. seniors, but the ultra-competitive specialties generally have a fill rate greater than 90%. So we are certainly in reach for many non-LCME applicants, especially those who play this game correctly. So given that, we're going to talk strategy with our program directors and get their advice for our non-LCME independent applicants. And we're going to start with a focus on osteopathic students who want to match to an allopathic residency program. And to lead us off, we're going to be chatting with Dr. Merle Carter from Albert Einstein, which is a duly accredited program. So we're going to start with the first question, Merle. What is a duly accredited program?
So that's a great question. For those students who aren't aware of what that means, is that there, you should understand that there are two accreditation bodies who accredit and oversee programs, both DO programs and MD programs. And so there's something called the Accreditation Council for Graduate Medical Education and the AOA. And so programs are accredited by a national oversight, those two national oversight organizations, to be sure that there are predefined essential elements of training that are in place in those institutions. And so institutions get audited by those two organizations to make sure those elements are in place. And typically programs are either accredited by one or the other, either an ACGME program, and typically that's an allopathic or an MD program, or an AOA program would be overseen by the AOA accrediting body. But there are a few programs out there that are overseen and accredited by both, like us. And what that means really just for us is that there's twice the level of sort of scrutiny and oversight that we have to make sure that all of the elements are in place that the AOA and the ACGME I want to make sure is in place for residents and training in emergency medicine. So we have sort of the best of both worlds in place, are overseen by both of those accreditation bodies. So it's sort of like the IRS of residency programs.
Well, you know, if I move the camera just slightly, I could point to the AOA building and the ACGME building.
Oh, that's
just
great.
A few blocks from my office. They're right behind me. Yeah, they're controlling this whole thing over there. So tell me about the advantages or disadvantages, I guess, in the match for osteopathic students who want to pursue an allopathic residency. You know, would they be looking at your program in specifically or perhaps more advantageously than other programs?
Well, that's a great question, and it's a difficult one to answer sort of in general terms, because what we typically recommend to students is defined really on and based on the student's situation. They may have some geographic constraints that are dictating where they're applying to. They may have some issues related to their application that may make them more or less competitive. And so we tend to sit down with each student and try to strategize which type of program they might be best suited for. You know, we do get a lot of questions from students, both, you know, who try to decide, should they go to the DO match, because there are two matches. Should they go through the DO match? Should they go through the allopathic match? And that decision really needs to be weighed and balanced against how competitive they are as an applicant, what, you know, or where in the country they feel that they might need to be applying, what their application looks like in terms of their extracurriculars and things, what their board scores look like, for example, and what some of the programs may consider as competitive COMLEX or USMLE scores, and we can talk about that as well. But, you know, from our perspective, and it's just my opinion, I think that dually accredited programs, at least right now, until the ACGME and the AOA sort of finalize this marriage and until everybody's under the same umbrella, there are some advantages of a dually accredited program in that the residents, the DO residents, once they graduate, can sit for either boards. They can sit for the MD or DO boards in emergency medicine when they're done. They could go for fellowships that historically may have only been open to those residents that may have been eligible or graduates from ACGME programs. So there are some doors that may be still left open to someone who's going to a dually accredited program. But in the next couple of years, I think that that's really not going to be an issue.
Okay. So you spoke about the DO match and MD match. What are the differences in timeline, number of positions?
Oh, sure. That's a great
considerations,
question.
Considerations, I think, that the osteopathic applicants.
So there are two matches. So the DO match tends to happen earlier in the academic year. And for the purposes of interview season is the same for the most part. The applicants are interviewed around the same time. The applications come in at around the same time. Where the difference is that programs and applicants make their decision and make their rank lists earlier in January, for example. The rank lists are due for the DO match in January, mid-January, and the match for the DO match is in the beginning of February. I think February 8th, I think, this upcoming year. For the NRMP match, that's a little bit later. Those match lists aren't due until the end of February, and then the match is not until the middle of March. From the perspective of the student, often the student knows that they may only want to be in one match or another. They may not know which match they want to be in. And so at some point, we recommend that they sit down with their clerkship director or their program director of the places where they're rotating and have a frank discussion with them about their viability in for the programs that they're considering based on their application, their board scores, their preclinical scores, all of the aspects of their application to get some sense of what their viability would be for some of these programs. And that may help direct them toward one match versus another. There are times when we would recommend that someone just be in the DO match. There are times when we recommend that they try the DO match first and then go into the NRMP if the DO match was unsuccessful. And then still for others, if the geographic location where they're applying only has ACGME programs, then their only options really are to apply to those programs. So there's a lot of variables that go into that decision. And to sort of make general recommendations about which match someone should do is really for an individual conversation with that student.
Yeah, it's always bothered me that the DO match was first, right? I mean, not to be insulting you to the AOA, but it seems like it would be a little harder for you to match in a different match than your own if you're an osteopathic student. So why is it first? Because if you really wanted to challenge the allopathic match and then still have your match to kind of back you up, it seems like it should be second. I think that's just another layer of complexity.
Right. At some point, we've been at all of the dually accredited programs, and, you know, a lot of the programs on either side have been advocating for one match, and I think eventually it will get to that. Once we're all married, there will eventually be one match, so this discussion will likely go away. I think for the next couple of years, the students will still have to make some decisions on which match they're going to do. I will say that for some, there is some safety and some comfort in applying to one match first and seeing how it goes, and then applying into the second one thereafter. But it does create a lot of anxiety. I think for the DOs, it's very anxiety-provoking because they have to decide whether to forego one match and go into the second match, or try one and get maybe their second or the third choice program in the DO match when they might have gotten their first choice in the NRMP. So there's a lot of factors and strategy that goes into that decision-making that really requires a one-on-one conversation.
Yeah, so Michelle, I'm looking forward to like season 4 when we have an episode called The Marriage. Or implications of the marriage.
Yeah.
That'll be fun. I'm going to plan for that for the next 2 years. All right, Merle, give me some advice for osteopathic students who want to go into the allopathic match only. They're not worried about sort of toggling between the two. You know, how do they present themselves as competitive as they might be and really strategize about this allopathic match?
Sure. I think that's a great question. You know, and it's sort of similar advice that I would give to most students. But I think in particular, probably for the DO applicants who feel that they may be, either in reality or just perception, may be a little bit behind the eight ball here. So one is I would try to do rotation at some of the places that you really like. Obviously, if it's an allopathic program, try to do an audition rotation there. Clearly, you want to do a good job there. Remember that emergency medicine is a small world, so you don't want to blow off a rotation that's maybe at the bottom of your list, and you want to do well there. So you want to do a good job. That's the first thing. Second thing is make sure that your application is as pristine as it can be. There's nothing, you know, program directors hate seeing typos and grammatical errors. Follow instructions on the application. If it says don't go over one page on your personal statement, don't go over one page on your personal statement that says something about you that you can't follow instructions and things like that. There's often a question about whether or not to take the USMLEs. For those DO students who take the COMLEX, they have questions, well, should I take the USMLE as well to be more competitive? And I would say it sort of depends on the program that's considering you. Some programs are well versed and well equipped to be able to interpret the COMLEX scores. Some who don't have a long history with DO applicants don't really know how to interpret the COMLEX scores relative to USMLEs. And occasionally I will get a phone call from a program director who will say, I have an applicant that has a COMLEX of this. How does that equate to a USMLE score so that they can be able to compare apples to apples? Sometimes we will recommend to students that if you tend to do well on your COMLEX and you have the time, the inclination, and the money to take the USMLEs, then by all means, you can certainly do that. That might help your chances. If you tend not to do well in the COMLEX, do not risk doing poorly on the USMLEs. That would be a death sentence probably for you in terms of getting your foot in the door. But like anything, if once you get your foot in the door, once you're invited for an interview, that program has felt that you are a viable applicant and you should shine when you go there. I'm not sure that there's really too much, you know, in the way of how to distinguish yourself that I would. It's just like any other medical student. You want to do well in your preclinicals. You want to be able to have good board scores, and you want to shine when you go for your interviews.
Yes. Just as a plug, all of the information from season one about ARIS and how to be competitive, go click around on Allium. Michelle, you have a question?
Yeah, I had a question for you, actually. I wanted to butt in to Merle because I think you bring up a great point about having really individualized advising and mentorship about choosing, you know, which of these routes you want to go. And I know, what if for some reason a student feels like they want to do MD and DO programs, right, mm-hmm. residency programs to apply to, who do they go to for advice short of everybody contacting you? Is there a system or a listserv or a form or a resource that you can kind of point them to? Sorry to put you on the spot.
That is a fantastic question, actually. In terms of who does a medical student go to if they have an interest in applying to all of these different places and
exactly.
where they go? I'm not aware that there is such a listserv, frankly. And I think probably the best places to go to are the clerkship directors and the program directors of the places where you're rotating. Clearly, they have the most experience in navigating these types of things. If you can get a rotation at a dually accredited program, those program directors and clerkship directors are probably the most seasoned in being able to navigate some of this decision-making with you. Of course, we're always available if you feel like you have really no one to turn to or go to. Certainly, I'm more than welcome to try to answer some of your questions and steer you in the right direction, but it's very individualized. And what advice I would give one student in my office, the next hour I would meet with a different student with a different set of circumstances, I would give a different level of advice to. So I would really encourage people to try to find a trusted mentor that has been doing this for a long time, that has perspective at least on both sides of both DO and MD if they can.
Yeah, that's a great answer. And I think, actually, if those of you who are DOs in that situation, if you could actually pay it forward and kind of jot down everything in a journal of what you've learned in this process, unfortunately, it doesn't help you, but, you know, maybe we could start a trend of paying it forward and share the lessons that you've learned so you can mentor those in the future. But I haven't found any good resources. And that's
well, I just want to put a plug in for the ACOEP. It's the American College of Osteopathic Emergency Physicians. They have resources for medical students and residents. The residents and medical students can be members of that. And so there are listservs and forms and things on that website as well that residents and students can go to. So I put a big plug in for the ACOEP.
Perfect. Well, you know, viewers, this is why I love Merle, because she has such a big heart. Did you see her when she was just about to say, well, you can all just email me? And then she realized the frontal cortex limbic system for a moment. And she was like, oh, no, I can't do that. And I have her secret Gmail address, as does all of the panelists that I'm not going to share, but it's a good one. All right, so we're going to do a new segment. We're going to do a lightning round of all of our panelists. I'm going to ask each of you four questions. Please keep it brief. But this is the stuff I think that the viewers want to know. So we're going to start with Doug, our osteopathic graduate, who's a vice chair at an allopathic program. There's your future. All right, here we go. Lightning round. Do you strongly consider osteopathic candidates at Hackney?
Absolutely. And absolutely. I think like all of us, there's certain criteria you're looking for, which are across the board, be it traditional or non-traditional candidates. Second, what Merle said, if somebody actually has the qualifications, the skills, the type of resident that we're looking for, and they're screened through and they're in the interview process, then it's fair game for everybody.
Great. Well, that's question two. What makes an osteopathic student competitive in your shop?
So in our shop, it's someone who's demonstrated the ability to excel as a medical student. And whether that's rotating with us or elsewhere, you can certainly read between the lines when you're talking about the slows, but also that has the perspective of someone where the fit makes sense for emergency medicine. I'm really thrilled that we're doing this because one of the concerns I have in mentoring medical students is often the advice that they're getting and where they're getting that advice. Hopefully this will help in terms of allowing osteopathic students and international medical graduates to be more competitive.
Can osteopathic students rotate in your ED in hopes of getting the golden ticket, the slow that they need?
Yes, absolutely. That's actually a new thing for us. We have students that rotate from St. George's. We have about 6 to 8 per month. We have students from Rutgers, the allopathic program, approximately 2 per month. And now we actually have students rotating from not only osteopathic students, but other programs throughout the country. So we've just recently opened that up, but there is limited slots. There's about 2 or 3 per month additional. So it's really a matter of doing your homework, putting in the application, and securing one of those spots.
And those are through VSAS, correct?
Last year it wasn't, next year it will be, because we literally just opened this. So we had to do it sort of old school. Yeah.
Well, that's hot off the press news then for those who are watching this in a timely fashion. Last question. Have you matched an osteopathic student at Hackensack?
Absolutely. In fact, one of our chief residents right now is an osteopathic student. So absolutely.
One would think since you're the vice chair, but okay, I had to ask. Yeah. All right, let's go. Since we got kind of a good answer there, a little bit faster. Damon, do you strongly consider osteopathic candidates?
Oh, absolutely. I think the one issue that I will tell people is we do not take Comlex. Everybody has to take the USMLE to apply to our program. And this is sort of the behind-the-scenes stuff, and I want to be honest about it. I'm sure, Mike, you've been in those meetings with your dean and your DIO and having to report what the average USMLE scores are for your class. Just when I tell strong DIO applicants is take that off the table. Just get in. Our medical school at Virginia Tech requires all of our students to take the USMLE. Our dean expects to see it in our graduates of our residency programs as well. But absolutely, we have usually 1 or 2 in every class.
Okay, so what makes an osteopathic student competitive? You said taking USMLE. What else?
At our program, you know, we look for leadership and scholarly achievement. And consistently what we see in the DO students is they have less opportunities to do research. And so I would say to be competitive, seek out scholarly work and make sure that's in your portfolio. Really try to emphasize that you've reached out away from a school that maybe you didn't have many resources to do that and you found it somewhere else that shows a resourceful, energetic person that's going to fit in well to our program.
Okay. Can they rotate at your shop for slow?
Absolutely. And I want to finish with emphasizing, as a DO applicant, reach out outside of your circle of mentorship, maybe at your shop or school, and find somebody in the ACGME or LCME world and have them do a good overview of your portfolio, your CV, give you honest advice. I'll never steer anybody wrong, just like Merle says. Get some external advice. Have somebody look at that portfolio, and nobody's going to fib you.
Yep. And then I know the answer to this. You've matched an osteopathic student in your program. That is correct?
We sure have. And one of them is our chief resident right now.
All right. Good to see a theme here, guys. All right. Quick answers for Michelle and I. Do you guys consider osteopathic candidates at UCSF?
Question for me? Oh, I didn't know. Oh,
yeah,
here.
Okay,
I will be super brief. I have a six-word answer for all four questions. What? Yes. And just like
the
MDs.
The question is competitive.
Yeah. Right? The second one is how do you be competitive, which is just like for the MD applicants, be awesome. Do they rotate?
Awesome.
Yes. Yes, they rotate. And 4, have you matched? Not yet. 7 words.
Not yet.
Not yet.
All right. Okay, I'm going to do the same thing. Do you strongly consider osteopathic candidates? Yes, I read all the applications myself. If so, what would make an osteopathic student competitive? Merle used the phrase apples to apples, and I think that's what Damon's getting at. I need to see you look like all of the other candidates in my pool of applicants as much as possible. And if you don't look like those other candidates, it's very difficult for me to interpret how competitive and talented you really are. Last year, there were several calls made to me from folks who are advocating for osteopathic students who are apparently ranked very high in their class. But other than class rank, there was nothing else in their file I could use to compare apples to apples. They didn't take the USMLE. They didn't have a slow. They didn't rotate at an allopathic program. So for me, you got to look like my students. If you want to match to an allopathic program, rotate at an allopathic program. Get a slow from an allopathic program director. Take the allopathic boards, right? Like that's sort of my general message. Can they come rotate at our shop? Unfortunately not. Northwestern's one of those that doesn't let that happen. We have on our Feinberg homepage who is eligible to come rotate at our school, and I would refer folks to that webpage. And then have you matched an osteopathic student in your program? Not yet, but I have ranked them in very matchable positions, people. So as long as you play the game and you look like the rest of the folks, I will certainly screen you in that same fashion. All right, so moving right along, we are going to go Dr. Finifrock, our osteopathic vice chair, by the way. We're going to keep referring to that. And we're going to move on to the international medical grads. So we just heard, Doug, some of the characteristics that make the osteopathic medical students more competitive. So can you describe to me the file of an international medical grad who would equally be considered competitive for our matches?
Sure. Well, there's similar themes here. I think that it's competitive across the board, first of all. And so, you know, if you think about it, the program director is going to look at this in various stages. So there's the initial screening process in terms of consideration for an interview. And that's the part, I think, where there should be the most focus on. And I want to second what you said for the osteopathic students, similarly for the international medical graduates, is do you look the same? Have you rotated at the same places? One of the challenges I know sometimes is securing a rotation where you can get a slow. And just to sort of understand, you know, I think a lot of us are looking for a certain amount of criteria in our screening process, because I'm sure with established programs that you all are at, that you receive, if not 1,000 applications for your spot. So even to reach the point of considering who can we possibly interview, it's important to look similar. And so with that, it's dotting the I's and crossing the T's. Having what I'd say at least both step one and step two complete, in file, ready to go. Having slows from multiple places where we recognize the comparative value of those slows. I think that it actually appears different if, say, you just have a letter recommendation from one particular individual. And even to the point where maybe you have that letter from someone in another specialty that says you're the best thing since sliced bread, sometimes we're wondering, well, why don't you just go into psychiatry if they love you that much there? But I think at least being able to demonstrate that there's multiple sites, ideally two, if not perhaps three slows, which I understand is difficult to get. These are the types of things I think you have to do in advance just so you look similar. Well, at least I think this leads back to probably part of the core of this conversation is what are the obstacles? So I think that just for us to take a step back, I think it's very important to understand the data and really understand that to some degree it is an uphill challenge and you have to be ready for that. So I'd like to refer you to an article that just came out in Annals of Emergency Medicine in May 2015. And it was by the American Board of Emergency Medicine Task Force on Residency Training. And essentially, it's the data from the 2013-2014 residency match. In that match, there's 5,600 residents that matched. 330 were international medical graduates, so that's 6% of that total group. 710 were osteopathic students, so that's 12% of the total. But what's also interesting as part of the strategy here is to really have a sense where your best shot is in terms of applying. It's one thing just to apply broadly, but I think it's also important to know where to strategically position yourself. So the majority of the international medical graduates is noted in this article, 61% actually went to five states. So those five states were Michigan, New Jersey, New York, Ohio, and Pennsylvania. So I think that's important information to know, especially in considering geographical differences. And then once you're armed with that, I think you get the best advice you can. I would start off with your own medical school. Get a list of where the residents matched last year in emergency medicine. On top of that, take a look at the individual programs to ensure if they actually have matched. And I think it's encouraging to hear Dr. Jasandi say that, you know, there are, like, you know, say at his shop, there were actually candidates in position to match, but it just didn't happen to appear, you know, when you do your research. So don't be afraid, certainly, to apply to places. But on the other hand, if it's me, you know, I would certainly be applying to places who've established that they've had graduates. And I can tell you, I have worked with fantastic international medical graduates and know several in top leadership positions in our field. So certainly wouldn't have it to be a deterrent, but I would also have a real strong plan B just in case, because it is a battle. But I think if you approach it like that and you give it your best, you know, at the end of the day, you'll feel comfortable with the outcome. At least you know that you gave it your best and you were armed with the resources to make it happen.
That is excellent advice, and I'm really glad that you referenced that article. Michelle, I'm going to speak for you and say that we'll put that citation up on the Allium website as part of the resources for this talk. I do want to clarify, though, you said 5,000 people matched and, you know, X percentage. Or, that's not to EM. That's the total map, right?
Let me just pull it back for a second.
There's only about 1,800 spots to EM every year at this point.
Well, let's take a look at this. So it has...
Or is that across a number of years, perhaps? I'm not sure.
The way that they phrase it, and I have to look at it a little closer, it does say the demographic comparisons for emergency medicine residents and residents in related specialty areas for the previous academic year, which was 13-14 from the National GME Census. And at least according to this, they have the total residents being 5,600. So I'll have to look in their resources more to see, you know, maybe that was inclusive of others, but it's in a table 3 breakdown here. So it's, I think that just sort of points out, because I think we started the broadcast in saying, hey, 20%, 1 out of 5 isn't bad. But also I think there's a little bit of a difference between the osteopathic in terms of the percentage versus the IMGs. So just information to be aware of, so you're armed with all the data you have.
Yeah, I just totally created Program Director Journal Club there, which I'm telling you, I wasn't a big fan back when I would get called on in Journal Club, so that's why you're the vice chair. All right, so, you know, we talk about competitiveness across all these different candidate groups, and I certainly receive emails from candidates who, you know, feel like they should just be evaluated like every other grad of every other school. And I've said on this series before, not all schools are the same. Are all international medical schools the same? I think we have to have big boy, big girl talk about this.
Yeah. So I think that they won't be all viewed the same. And I think that part of it depends on the experience that certain institutions have had. I can speak for our institution. We have students from St. George's. And so we have 50 medical students per class that rotate with us. So we rotate. We see them. We know them. Our international medical graduates in our residency program are from St. George's. Ironically, an hour ago, I just interviewed someone for our residency program who's rotating with us from St. George's. So we have a familiarity with that program. We actually do our interviews for everyone that rotates with us and also kind of provide some advice in their application, sort of some mentorship along with that. But so I think there is a difference, but it's more based upon familiarity. So I think that that's also something that you can look at and do your homework and just have a good sense of where you're interviewing and certainly look at the faculty there, because I'm sure you'll find that there'll be at least some member of the faculty that probably is from an international medical school. So it's worth doing your homework there too. Along with that, just the other thought I had is that part of the process, I think, is to not only have a mentor, but to have someone who's really going to advocate for you and it's on your side. So part of that is perhaps finding out someone you can identify with, maybe someone that went to the same school, someone that sees, you know, they may see themselves in you and will end up being your advocate. And that's often the difference between getting interviews and not getting interviews.
Yeah, I'm sorry to cut you off there. My only comment about this familiarity is really it extends past just, is it familiar with the Caribbean medical schools or not? It's more, are you familiar with a non-English speaking medical school? I mean, to be all and honestly, like, I'm pretty familiar with the Australian medical schools. I have a good sense of where they sort of fall out internationally. But if it's a non-English speaking medical school, I have trouble. And I've asked our medical school DIO in past years, do you have some sort of guide or rubric or ranking for these folks? And we don't. I mean, you know, much like we don't have a great resource for the osteopathic students, we certainly don't have a great resource past perhaps the English-speaking medical schools around the world. So familiarity is a really important thing. And if for folks that are watching this, I feel badly every year when I see hundreds of international medical grads send applications to me that I have a very hard time trying to interpret in this sort of apples to apples analogy I made. Doug, any final advice about the IMGs? And we're going to go to our rapid fire panel. I think perhaps we could talk maybe about observerships and the value of those and maybe visas.
Sure. Same advice I'd give to anybody applying. I think if you have the opportunity to observe, that's important equally for you as it is for them, just to have a little more time. We actually do 4 hours after the interview. I know other places maybe do longer, and hopefully most places allow some form of an observership. I would definitely take advantage of that if it's a place you're seriously considering, as much for you as it is for them. For us personally, it doesn't have any bearing on the rank at all. We actually do a rolling rank where we're actually ranking people right after the interview day. So if it's you're observing afterwards, you know, we've already kind of gathered together and we just, you know, it's just a personal thing we have that we think that everyone's fresh in our mind. So the faculty meets and does that sort of in real time. But I think just for you to have the ability to get a real true sense of what that program's like, if you have the opportunity, by all means, to meet up the night before before with a dinner or whatever's offered and talk to as many residents as possible. I think these are the types of things that are more for the applicant than just from the program's evaluation. In terms of your question about
I'm going to table the visa for a second. I think what I was really asking about observerships is this concept where an international medical graduate who perhaps can't actually obtain a rotation in an allopathic school and get a SLO will send an email to a program director and say, can I just come hang out in your shop for a month?
Yeah.
And then list that on their CV in some manner that, you know, may or may not be advantageous to their application. I think perhaps what you were describing was like a second look.
Yeah.
So, sort of observership for that.
Sure. But, my apologies. I think it certainly doesn't hurt to ask, and they'll let you know what the institutional policy is. We have a policy that because of the relationship with an international medical school that we actually do not allow that. Sometimes we have people who've graduated and want to do that. So I think it just depends on the institution. But if it is allowed, I think that'd be a great idea. I think that'd be very advantageous.
Okay, maybe you could speak to the visa issue and then we're going to go to our lightning panel.
Yeah, I think the visas, I mean, at least from people I've spoken with, I think it's a matter of the first question is whether the institution will sponsor or not. And a lot of times that's just simply a yes or no answer. And keep in mind, a lot of these things that you'll discover are not necessarily the views of the program directors, but the views of the institution themselves and the Merle Carters of the world, who are the designated institutional officers who are helping us all find our way. So I think it's often at a higher level than the program itself. And so often these questions have been answered before, and they can pretty much give you a simple yes or no answer.
Okay, great. Thanks. All right, so we're going to go to our panel. I think these are going to be somewhat similar answers to our last lightning round. So qualify if you need to qualify. We'll start with Merle. Do you strongly consider international medical graduates at Albert Einstein?
We do, for sure. Yes.
What makes them competitive, particularly at your shop?
I think the same thing that Doug mentioned and also that Damian mentioned. You know, you want them to look as much like all of the other applicants as possible. Clearly, if we have some relationship with that school in the past, we know the St. George's folks very well, we know the Ross students very well. If we have had a relationship with that school, then that makes them more competitive for sure.
Okay. Can they rotate in your shop to get a SLO?
You know, it's interesting. In our state right now, Pennsylvania does not permit foreign medical students, international medical students, to rotate in our institutions. So we are not permitted to have that right now.
Yep. And have you matched an international grad in your program?
Oh, for sure. Yes, we have. And have been chiefs in our programs, too. So, okay. Yes.
All right, David, same questions.
We don't consider them unless they have rotated with us. We have to know them. The process for getting a rotation within our institution as an IMG or international is very difficult, but it is doable. Check out the website. It's through our Virginia Tech Carilion School of Medicine, and certainly we would welcome you to apply for a rotation, but that is the only way we'll consider you.
Okay. And let's go to the last competitive one of that group. Have you matched one yet?
We have not. Nope. Still waiting for our first.
Michelle.
Yeah, you know what? I've been out of the program director loop and the leadership loop in a while that you'll see that there's so many permutations of these answers. I don't know where we're at now at UCSF, so I'll find out and I'll get back to you.
Okay. All right. You know, I'll tell you that I, just like the osteopathic students, I read all of the international medical graduate folks myself. My program leadership divides up the allopathics. So I look at everyone, similar to the osteopathic students, it's an apples to apples comparison. The more you look like a US graduate, the easier it is for me to interpret your application. And they rotate in our shop, no asterisk. If you go to our website at Feinberg, we actually have a number of international medical schools that partner with Feinberg, where Northwestern kids can go there and their folks can come to our shop. And that's the only list of international grads who can come to Northwestern. And I think that's fairly common around the country. I mean, becoming more common. So perhaps that is a strategy for certain folks to figure out from their dean's office at their medical school abroad, who are my partner or sister institutions and how do I get my foot in the door? And then have we matched one in our program? We have not in the last 3 decades. I think we did once. We're a 44-year-old program, so we did once in the past. All right, so we are going to move on to my friend, Dr. Damon Keel, and we're going to turn our attention to two groups, the U.S. military servicemen and women who have gone abroad and, or I guess in the United States, have given military service and are coming back to the allopathic match, as well as U.S. allopathic grads who've had training in other specialties. And much like Damon's entire life, I'm going to preface his answers with my own personal opinion. He's used to this. So I think every PD in America should strongly consider our U.S. servicemen and women. They have dedicated Amen. Their lives to our country. There is no reason that we should be marginalizing these applicants yes. in the match. That being said, we are here to help you sell yourself, because while I love you guys and women, I have no idea what any of those letters and awards you have mean. So you need to help me contextualize that, and that's why we have
the It means they're going to be great residents. That's what it means.
So let's do advice for our returning U.S. military servicemen and women, Dr. Keel.
Well, let me preface it first by saying what's my experience and what's our shop have to do with all of this. Currently, my associate program director is a former Navy man, did his general medical officership there. So we do have a culture of that. My current chief resident is a Naval Academy graduate and a captain of a very big ship for a significant portion of his previous career. We have, in our intern class, we have a former P-3 sub-hunter pilot who is a fantastic resident from University of Washington. So I love these applicants, but I'm going to give you a couple of points to really focus on, and I'm going to give you a little insight. I think all the program directors will agree that there's two things that you have to understand. People with prior careers, prior training, set off a little bell in the back of our heads which says, are they trainable or not, or retrainable. Always somebody who is a former nurse, a former paramedic, who spent 20 years in that career, and I have both of those people in my program as well. We have to ask ourselves sometimes, is this person trainable in emergency medicine? Will they make that transition out of a long, very illustrious career in the military into emergency medicine where there's a little bit more chaos, perhaps we need more creativity? That's always one of the questions. So I will say the first thing you have to do is present yourself in a way that you are open and eager and new ideas. That is, I think, if I'm interviewing you in front of me, those are the things that you really want to present yourself. And I think it's a little bit of a danger, even though you've maybe had, like Mike said, you got a lot of medals and awards and you were captain of something. Again, that doesn't translate very well for me. Now, my associate program director translates for me as a former captain and tells me what those mean. But at the same time, you have to translate those into everybody speak. And really what we're looking for is somebody who is open to learning and learning new things. And that's the first thing, saying that you got to sell yourself as somebody who's easily trainable in whatever program you go to. That's number one. Number two, I would say, is the culture of the program. What we're looking for as program directors is we have, you know, Mike's been doing this for a long time, Merle's been doing this for Doug, everybody's been, we have a culture in our program, and so when you're presenting to the emergency department in my shop, do you fit into the culture? And now, I'll tell you this, we're looking for leaders in our program, we're looking for people who are interested in scholarly achievement. Those sometimes get split in military service. We have strong leadership but less scholarly achievement. And so I will tell all of the U.S. military applicants out there, that's really part of your career that you need to focus on going into the match, is what is your scholarly work and how does that translate into the culture of the program? We do have a lot of requirements in our program in terms of quality improvement, leadership, that we're going to expect you to translate your skills into that. And so those would be the two things that I would say would really focus for a U.S. military. But in the end, I usually look at them and for the most part, call them chief resident.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think both of those points are spot on. And, you know, it really must be very frustrating for many of these docs who've gone abroad, who've been, you know, on the battlefield, criking people and putting chest tubes in, and then they come back and they have to be an intern. And it's, I mean, it's a little demoralizing. I just saved hundreds of folks' lives abroad, and now you're going to put me through intern procedure boot camp. Okay, deep breath, right? So it's those folks, if you can have that leadership, great training, and a little bit of patience to be able to start back at the beginning and work your way up. As soon as you get to the point where we want to let you go, you're going to fly like an eagle. That was a very good military. I didn't even come up with that earlier. All right. So we talked about the medals and the honors, and I think those are great, and they really help across the board for applicants. But sometimes I don't really know what it all means. I love that point about folks in your shop interpreting them. We're an Air Force kind of a place by virtue of our chair and vice chair and things. They help me quite a bit when I look at those. Any other tips for how our military service folks can prepare their ARIS application to make it more readable for those of us who perhaps don't have military experience?
Well, let's keep with the theme. Look like every other applicant. I'm going to be looking at issues around, so you're in military service, that is fantastic, but what other parts of your portfolio look like a regular applicant to my program? And we put a heavy emphasis on music. So when you come to our retreat, there's going to be a lot of banjos and keyboards and guitar. But we creativity is very important in our program. And we look for people who have demonstrated creativity in the arts, languages, doesn't matter. But make sure your portfolio looks balance with a lot of different pieces to it. And I would say, really, we all know on your application your strong military experience. So that may be not something that you spend as much time on in an interview or in your personal statement. Focusing on other areas, making yourself look like everybody else. And I will tell you that that's an important piece that I think sometimes I see missed. And I can't stress enough, I respect how much time you spent in the service. But at the same time, that's something that we're going to see on your application. And it may, I think I see in a lot of applicants from previous military experience, they put too much emphasis on that piece of it. And we miss other great aspects of your portfolio.
Yeah, and the looking like other applicants, the apples to apples analogy we keep using, is incredibly difficult for these guys and women. You know, they did their med school clerkships 5 years ago in some cases when they had no idea they wanted emergency medicine until they were in the service and they realized it's the coolest specialty. And then now they've made up their mind. I mean, their grade from 5 years ago was kind of useless to me. And their dean's letter, I mean, I guess I was doing this 5 years ago. I can interpret that. But I, you know, within the context of how they performed on their EM elective, if they did one at all, I mean, that's very difficult to stop. Maybe I just speak for the panel that we're sensitive to that, and as much as you can overcome that barrier, you know, we'll meet you halfway.
But at the same time, you've got to sell the fact that that you have seasoning. And I think as program directors, we're like, I'm taking somebody who already has some seasoning, and that's something you get to sell.
Like sage?
Yeah.
Earl was about to give the sage advice. Go for it.
I just wanted to jump in. So there is going to be a group of military that knew that they wanted to do emergency medicine, but in medical school were in the military and did not get deferred to go into the civilian match. And so a lot of their application will sort of harken back to having already prepared to do emergency medicine, but they needed to go out and do these other things. I would encourage for any program directors out there listening, I agree 100% with Damon. In fact, those were the applications that I would sort of look to first. You know, those are your leaders. Those are the people that work hard. Those are your chief residents. A lot of our chief residents have been our military just by virtue of the fact that they worked hard, did great, that kind of thing. But I agree with everything that's been said so far.
Yeah, no, you're telling stories. Several years back, I had a military applicant who did not get a deferment, who on our natural rank list was number 3. And I said, call me in 4 years when you come back. And bang, he applied on September 15th, a couple years back. And our program coordinator remembered him and was like, he applied again. Yeah, he's back. And he moved up to number 2. All right. Yeah. So,
wow, it was.
Yeah, right. Let's just change gears very quickly to the U.S. allopathic grads who have had prior training. And, you know, I'll tell you that the last episode for this season's EM Match Advice Season 2 is going to be focused on what do you do if you don't match. So we're not talking about the folks who didn't match last year and they're trying to reinvent themselves. I'm talking about folks who, like, did their prelim year, they're anticipating they're going to radiology, and they had a change of heart.
I know it's a plug for the next episode. They do tend to go hand in hand because it's common to see the applicant who didn't match an EM, is now doing his surgery prelim year. She's doing her internal medicine year. And that group of people is one I spend most of my time trying to advise, not only at our shop, but a lot of different places. Usually it's somebody who we interviewed and didn't land very high on our rank list and scrambled to a spot somewhere and now is emailing me or contacting me saying, hey, DK, what happened? What can I do now? There's two ways to go with the person with prior service. First is, again, try to look like other applicants. Other applicants have done rotations in emergency medicine, and they have strong letters of recommendation from departments of emergency medicine where there's a residency program. And this is a real disadvantage to those applicants with prior training who have not done their initial residency training at a shop that has an EM program. So the one thing I can tell you is if for some reason or another you are currently in a program that is a internal medicine, I've got a change of heart, I've got to go to emergency medicine, it's my life calling. See if you have an elective month, contact a few folks to see if you can't get an EM rotation somewhere. You're in Philadelphia or you're in Chicago, there's a lot of EM programs. See if there's any hope of you getting a rotation at one of those places to work in their emergency department. Critical. Have to have that letter in your file. Should be a strong letter. You have the cell that you already have some seasoning. Not sage, maybe tarragon, but you've got some experience, and program directors like that. You're not coming out green. You're a known quantity. So your program director in your previous program has to know you well and be able to sell you in emergency medicine. So I always advise people, if you're having a true career change, you're absolutely all into EM, get with your program director and your other specialty immediately. Let them know that. Don't fib around. Don't try to do it behind their back. That's not going to work. So please, that's one thing. Number two is, I think in applicants across the board is the real issue of above the cap funding and financing. Medicare pays most of residents' salary. Now, the advantage for all of you out there who are thinking about applying from another specialty is the fact is many programs have exceeded their Medicaid funding or their Medicare funding, and so they're above the cap, and they can accept you into their program and cover the cost. Now, the one issue I'll tell you, though, is program directors have to answer to the Merles of the world, which is how many of your residents get Medicare funding and what does it look like? So we do have budgets that we have to meet, so we're always hesitant to take those applicants who have had 2 or 3 years of prior training in another specialty. Now, American Board of Emergency Medicine is the ultimate handicapper when it comes to emergency medicine prior training. If you are in a program, you really have to be in that program continuously for 2 years to transfer credits into an emergency medicine program and get any approval from the American Board of Emergency Medicine that you had prior training. It's up to them. We try to match up. If somebody is, and I'll give my own experience here, we've had two different people in our program that have had prior training. One completed a family practice residency program, and one finished 2 years of an anesthesia program before transferring to our program. At both times, what you have to do is apply to the American Board of Emergency Medicine to get transfer credits. Our family practice graduate, we were able to give her 7 months of prior training, and she entered as a PGY2. And our anesthesiology resident, we were able to give him almost a full year of training, and he transferred in as a PGY2. It is possible, but again, try to make yourself look like other emergency medicine graduates with having letters of recommendation from emergency medicine residency programs, and that's where you absolutely have to start.
Yeah, I have lots of transfer resident experience at this place, and you know, same thing. I have a new PGY2 who finished internal medicine here, got 7 months. I have a senior who did several years of surgery, got 11 months. So there's, you know, quite a bit that you can get in the process that can shorten, you know, this extra training a bit. Very quickly, Damon, should they bring this up on interview day or not, this sort of transfer credit issue?
Absolutely. I mean, I think the one thing you can do beforehand to show that you have an interest in the program is look on their website, look at their block schedule diagram, and see how your rotations might have matched up. And say, hey, I already looked at your program and mine. It looks like I might be able to get, you know, almost a year's worth of credit. I think that's perfectly reasonable. We don't want any elephants in the room, and we know that's always going to be an issue. I'm going to bring it up when I'm interviewing somebody. But at the same time, if I'm interviewing you for a PGY1 spot, I'm trying to fill my class, and you finish your 3 years of internal medicine, don't ask me to get credit to be a PGY2 because you ain't going to get it.
Well, right, because if you match the person, they're not going to be able to fulfill the 3 years, then you have a schedule hole. So that's why it becomes a tricky question sometimes and a little bit of a loaded question, but I think I agree with you. Honesty above board, you know, that's going to make this process the best. All right, so this is nearing the end of an hour here, so Michelle's getting antsy. Let's turn the floor over to her. What questions or comments do you have? This was a great panel, by the way. I've learned a ton.
Yeah, I don't have any questions. You know, I've been taking tons of notes here this whole time, so I know I'm a little bit better versed in giving advice, and short of giving Merle's phone number to everybody, I'm going to put up a lot of these references for you guys to read, and I think be armed with information. I think that's going to be the key, apples to apples. That's kind of what I took out of this. So great panel.
Cool. So let's learn some new things, okay? Before we close, we're going to give our program directors a little free commercial as a thank you to their time and preparation today. And
we're my favorite part.
my favorite part too. All of our viewers who watch every episode know this is our favorite part. So we're going to start with Merle. So tell me something I don't know, Madam DIO, about Albert Einstein's EM program.
Something that you don't know. Let's see. Our program's the busiest in Philadelphia. I don't know that people know that. Yep, we're just over 100,000. We're in the scary part of town, which makes it great for training. We partner a lot with the other institutions in town to do a lot of citywide conferences, so the residents get to do a lot of networking with the folks at all of the other programs in town like Jeff, Drexel, Penn, Temple. So that's a great opportunity for them. Let's see. Our conference, oh, we have an innovative way that we do conference in that we have conferences that are specialty tailored for junior residents and senior residents. We split the groups up into half of the block. Some of them get senior level training. Some of them get more junior level core content level training. So that's sort of innovative, we think. And Philly is just awesome. So if you wanted good training and you want to see a lot of knife and gun club type of stuff, come to Philly.
Well, I learned a lot about that. I didn't know you guys were the busiest hospital. That's awesome. You're telling me something I didn't know. Applicants, I don't know who Merle's replacement is. I apologize.
Oh, I can tell you.
I met you. I can't wait to meet you. But
it's
Merle
Dr.
has
Deborah
created
Pierce.
A great shop there.
Thank you.
I'm sorry, Merle.
It's Dr. Deborah Pierce.
All right.
She's taking
I'm
over.
Looking for you, Dr. Pierce, at the next court meeting. But I'm going to tell you, Merle has been a star at court and has set up a wonderful program there. She is always the face I love to see when I walk into one of those boring court subcommittee meetings. And she smiles, and we give each other a hug. And if that is the kind of family she set up at Albert Einstein, you should absolutely check it out.
That's what's here.
So, all right, let's move across the state line and talk about the Hackensack Medical Center. Dr. Finifrock, tell me something I don't know about your program.
Absolutely. Well, I don't know if you knew this, and with respect to my esteemed colleagues on the line here today, but we have the best residents in the country. But
actually, all right.
I don't know if you know that. But that's really how
I've been waiting for that answer for two seasons. Yes.
Yeah, the best.
Now we found them.
But that's really how I see them, because I think they're great people. I think they're inspiring. They're really part of what has really shaped this program. We have a new program, and we count on their daily feedback to continue to get better every day. Great training ground. We see over 111,000 patients a year, very high acuity, tons of procedures. We've developed a pre-attending resident-run pod, so I feel like they're getting a great experience. But we have fun. There's a heavy focus on wellness. Just last week, we had a journal club at my apartment in New York City that went out to dinner afterwards, and we've created a resident wellness committee, and I challenged them to pick events frequently as possible, at least hopefully monthly. And I think that's what's kind of helped this to be a fun thing. And I'm very proud of our faculty. Our faculty have been inspired by the residents, several of which are fellowship trained, but really are just inspired on a daily basis to teach the residents and to mentor them because the residents are awesome. So I can go on and on about the residents, but that's really, in a nutshell, I think what really, really helps to make us unique in my mind.
Well, I'm glad to know where the best residents are. It's awesome. So when traveling through Hackensack, I'm going to feel very comfortable next time. World, you know, Doug runs a great shop there, and he has a wonderful focus on making you a well-rounded emergency physician that kind of thinks about what their job is going to be like later in the future. And that's how I got to know Dr. Finifrock, is on the patient satisfaction subcommittee of something, CORD, I think. Where he really described a great attitude and approach to teaching his residents what the markers of productive EP is going to be when they're post-graduation. And patient satisfaction is just one example. He has his own proprietary educational online webisodes, if you will, around that. He's really talented, and I was super happy he agreed to be on our panel today. So check out Hackensack, students. And now, I've been waiting for this one. I'm sorry, Merle and Doug, but you know, Damon and his wife, Karen, who's also faculty at Virginia Tech, two of my best friends in the whole world, so you're going to have to really try hard to tell me something I don't know about Virginia Tech.
Well, Mike, I know you've been here and given grand rounds, and you've been an incredible help in guiding my experience as a program director, so thank you for that. We are a county-busy hospital in the mountains, and that's certainly what we sell. People are like, how can you be a county-busy hospital? We are one of the largest, top 50 largest hospitals in the country in Roanoke, Virginia, and we have the beautiful Blue Ridge Mountains to go play in. I am 10 minutes away from one of the top mountain biking trails on the eastern seaboard, and one of the top 10 most beautiful hikes in the country is just 25 minutes away from our hospital's doors. What do we sell, though? Even though we're a huge hospital and a tertiary care for over 2 million people, we don't have orthopedic residents, we don't have urology residents, we don't have anesthesiology residents, we don't have ENT residents. So who gets to do all the cool stuff? So we really teach advanced critical care, advanced procedures. What I like to tell my residents is the unwritten chapters of Roberts and Hedges are all written in our emergency department.
That's awesome.
So it is it's a super fun place to train, but you also get some very unique things, which is including a rural rotation at one of our sites that is no subspecialty backup. You run that emergency department. You decide when to call the helicopter. We train residents who literally can go anywhere, world class. Last year, we had 6 of our 8 go into fellowships. The previous year, it was 5. We're happy to train people in community emergency medicine as well. But most people would readily assume it couldn't be that crazy busy place, but it is the 2nd busiest emergency department, largest emergency department in the state. And what you do not know, Mike, we're building a brand new emergency department and a new patient care tower. So we need to go over 1,000 beds to our hospital because we're a little bit overcrowded, and that's going to be coming online here in a few years.
I did not know that. I don't see why you need a new ED, because your first one is beautiful, by the way. It would make most residents jealous. World Damon is, much like Doug, a wonderful administrator and teaches those leadership skills that are such intangible sometimes in residency and so hard to teach. He teaches them flawlessly to his residents. He gives grand rounds on that very topic. He's come to Northwestern for that, and I was very appreciative. And I'll tell you, when I went to visit Roanoke, it's beautiful. If you've never been there, there's a big star up on the mountain and just has this hometown, wonderful feel to it right when you get off the airplane. So check out Virginia Tech Carilion. Michelle, any final comments?
No, thanks for sharing all of this. I know we went a little bit over, but I think there's such great information here that it was totally worth it. Totally worth it.
Great. If any of our viewers have questions, please post them to the Alium website. I know we maybe didn't cover every aspect to these sort of various subgroups of candidates, so please post your questions. We'll be happy to answer. Thank you to our panel, and good luck. It's September 15th. Good luck in the interview season.
Bye.
Thanks for joining us for this episode of Emergency Medicine Match Advice. You can view any of our episodes for free on Alium's YouTube channel, or if you prefer, listen to the episodes as Alium podcasts on SoundCloud. Also, check out summaries of our episodes as blog posts on Alium.com and in the publication A User's Guide to the Alium EM Match Advice series in the June 2017 issue of the Western Journal of Emergency Medicine. We love to hear from our listeners. Post your questions or comments for any of our episodes on Alium.com. Thanks for joining us.